Ethan Persoff behind us now, closing out the program live at Harry's Loft, 2009 release. The track When You Sleep, Do You Have Dreams? DDAA, prior to that, Déficit des Années Antérieures. Track I was actually looking for last week, went with another one then instead. So 2 weeks in a row, DDAA. Their cover of Faust's It's a Rainy Day, Sunshine Girl, retitled C'est une journée de pluie, from the release Bruit son petit sang. John Avery before that, from Jessica in the Room of Lights, we heard a song of the same title. We open that set with 1974 music from Brigitte Fontaine with the Resky from the great L'Incendie LP. Le 6 septembre, that's everything we heard. Hey, my name's Scott. Thanks for sticking with me today. I will see you next week. Stay tuned to Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, worldwide on the internet, WFMU.org. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is next. Sit tight.
I need your primary dial-up number if I'm going to start the transaction to get you onto the internet.
Just a moment.
What?
Yes, I'm handling this one. I've got it. I'm sorry, what? Go ahead, ma'am. Tech support 7D2.
Okay, you have a very, very peculiar way of dealing with customers.
I'm sorry, ma'am, I haven't started dealing with you yet. I was talking to the gentleman I'm working with.
Okay. I just got this free internet thing through Barnes & Noble. What?
I'm not aware of the free program. I'm just the tech support. Just a moment. Yes! Well, you didn't tell me about the free program. You, man! You didn't tell me about the free program! I'm sorry, go ahead, ma'am.
That's no way to talk on the phone. I'm just trying to get the sponsor.
Well, to be honest, this is my last day on the job, so I don't care if I get fired.
I go swimming up at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, uh-huh. And I listen to the problems of the rich, like while I'm sitting there poolside. Poolside poverty, that's my thing, but I listen to them while they're in the hot tub. Really, and they do talk about how the maid was late or how the grass hasn't been cut. They don't have the problems that I have. Like, I forgot to pull the garbage out for not just one, but the past 2 weeks now, and my neighbor's really furious at me because there's nowhere to put the garbage now.
So, wait. He's mad at you for not taking out your garbage or not taking out his garbage?
Well, it's not garbage because our two houses are supposedly connected. I have my own house. Remember, it's the world's smallest house?
Yes.
But the house next door, I guess, used to be part of this house. So for some reason, I'm the one that has to take the garbage out.
Why do you have to do it, though? Why do you have to?
Because he used to do it every week. But now that his feet are filled with gout or something, he has something wrong with his leg.
But, Peter, how did it become your responsibility? Did you guys have, like, a sit-down meeting to determine, okay, from now on, Peter will be taking out the garbage every Tuesday?
Well, because I took it out once, and then I took it out the next week, and then I took it out the next week, then I guess it's my job to take out the garbage, because now he refuses to take out the garbage. Taking out the garbage... It's a very simple thing, too. It's you just wheel the can from the sidewalk into the street. It's like you don't even do anything. I mean, except for they will not pick it up unless it's in the street. And you know, when it takes up all these parking spaces, people really hate garbage night, garbage morning, because it's another way for them to just take up parking spaces.
So, okay, I think I'm beginning to understand. So taking out the garbage is like the one simple thing that you're supposed to do every week, but every week you screw it up.
Tuesday night I seem to fall asleep around 7 o'clock. I don't know. I forget about it. I was looking forward to it all week long, too, taking the garbage out. Tuesday night, it's just like once you get over the just the horror and the fear of not parking your car on the correct side of the road on Monday and Tuesday, then you kind of like take a little breath, like, oh, I'm back on Easy Street, forgetting that there's one more thing, which is garbage day on Wednesday. So my problem right now is, what do I do? I didn't do it again last night. So is that a third world problem?
No, that actually sounds like first world, because the third world problem must be like you have to live with the garbage and you
right,
like
the garbage doesn't get emptied anywhere.
The garbage is in your bed, or the garbage is in your shower, or the garbage is in your kitchen. You know, you open the refrigerator,
right.
There's like garbage in there. Like
right.
The fact
you're sleeping
that, like,
on top of a mountain of garbage, and then you don't have too far to go to work because you work sifting through the garbage.
Exactly. So the fact that, like, you were, like, smoking crack or doing whatever, and you messed up and didn't take the garbage out, I think that you have a first world problem.
Okay, but the fact that it hadn't been taken out for a long, long time.
Whose fault is that? That's not like, you know, you being oppressed by, like, you know, forces. Like, I mean, you don't have a job. You're sitting there. Whose fault is it that didn't take out the garbage? That's a first world problem.
The guy that's getting angry, who's my neighbor, he's kind of a third world guy who does smoke the crack and everything.
Well, if he does do something to you, then I'm okay with making this a third world problem. But only, you know, if he gets violent or something.
Yeah, he could get violent because he's really nuts. One night I was coming home, and I saw him sitting on his balcony, which is right next to my balcony. He says to me, "Dude," and you know when somebody just calls you dude, that they're mad at you. Well, he was kind of like mad and sad, and this guy is like an ex-gangster, so it's really difficult to see him be sad. I mean, I'd rather just have him be mad in a gangster way. But his gangster days are really over. You know, he's my age. I mean, you would think he was much older because he'd already had the yoke of prison and all that stuff that it entails, that being a gangster entails. So he was sad and that the garbage did not get taken out. And I felt totally guilty about it, and that's why I can't believe that I went and forgot it again. I forgot it last night. In fact, I almost want to go knock on his door and tell him some lie, you know, about how the garbage man didn't come or something like that, because I know that he's in there, and that's, he doesn't work. He's kind of like me, but I kind of do stuff even though I don't work. But he'll sit there and brood about the garbage all day long, and he's probably brooding about it right now.
What if he has a gun under his mattress that he hasn't used in like 10 years since his last, you know, gangster thing? And he's like, that's it. I've had it. I've had it with this guy, and I'm going to plug him.
I'm not afraid of people with guns. You know, I was kind of disappointed when I came to Los Angeles. Remember they were shooting, they had drive-by shootings, and then they would...
Yeah, you know, like highway snipers.
Yeah, the highway snipers, all this stuff. I never saw any of them, but I was packing a piece just in case. Well, actually, the piece that I was packing, I might have even told you this. I took from the set. I was on the set of a TV show that was one of the many that involved guns, cops and robbers, and I was a cop. So I kept the gun as a souvenir because it is as close as you can get to looking like a real gun. Can't believe it, man. I have my gun, and all my gangster friends are really, really excited. They all want my gun. And I tell them it's not even a real gun. They don't believe me. By the way, I just noticed while I'm telling you the story, my gun isn't here anymore. Somebody did steal it. Somebody stole my gun. Now I'm powerless because, like, I act like, you know.
What are you talking about? You haven't even noticed that your gun was gone.
But I remember I put it right up next to the smiley face underneath the, I have my Jews. I call them my Jews. Maybe you remember, it's a statue of them all reading the Torah. Six of them, so it's not quite the Last Supper. It's like half of the Last Supper. And the gun was underneath the Torah, above the smiley face. But I see just the smiley face and the Jews with no gun. So that means that one of the gangsters that comes over to visit me periodically stole my gun. They steal from their friends, you know.
Well, maybe it was your neighbor.
If the fake gun makes him less sad, then I guess it's okay.
You know, it's funny that you describe the former gangster as sad, because whenever I see, like, a down-and-out older guy who's got, you know, fading, scary neck tattoos, I immediately assume that he must be, you know, like an ex-gangster who's now stuck in the square
world. I love those neck tattoos. That's because if they get knifed, like, somewhere, they wake up in a pool of blood, they don't know who they are. They can always look at their neck.
I think mostly, though, it's because of Roosevelt Island. Because if you take a tram to Roosevelt Island, there is this whole physical therapy rehab place right there on the water. And it's actually filled with these guys who are now confined to wheelchairs. You know, the kind where you have to, you know, bite down on the white straw thing to make the wheels go? I mean, really,
no.
Really brutal stuff. And I was going there for a while to take pictures, and I think one day I just got this idea in my head that all these guys, you know, in the wheelchairs, you know, driving around biting on the straws were all ex-gangsters. And I don't think it was because of the injuries or the palsy or the jerky stroke movements. I think it was because of the way that they just looked out at the city. There was like this grim acceptance in their eyes that they, you know, they were no longer tough guys. They were no longer in the game.
Right, like my neighbor.
I imagine it's sort of like, you know, how warriors used to talk, you know, like you're supposed to die in battle, you never want to die old. And, you know, it seems like, why wouldn't you want to die old? But I think, you know, this is probably what they're really talking about, you know? You don't want to go from being a gangbanger to, like, you know, living next door to some dumb guy who can't remember to take the garbage out. You know, I just don't think he dreamed it would end this way. So maybe he stole your gun to end it all.
Well, it's a pretty realistic-looking fake gun.
I know, but what if he tries to commit suicide with your fake gun? You know, he, like, pulls the trigger, like, his emotional moment, sticks it in his mouth, and finds out that it's fake. I mean, then he's going to be really mad. Do you know Union Square?
Yes, I do.
You do? Okay, so you know it has those...
Everybody does. That's the one with the Arc de Triomphe.
No, that's Washington Square Park.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know Union Square, no. I know the one with the Arc de Triomphe.
That's Washington. Union Square is the one with the steps. There's like a lot of steps where people come together to sit on. And it's actually one of my favorite places to hang out because the cops have cracked down on smoking in the parks. You're now not allowed to smoke in the parks. They'll give you a ticket.
Oh, my God, really?
Yes. So Union Square is the one where they're... You know, they know there will just be too many riots because it's just it's a really nice place to congregate. So tonight, I went there with my friend Bill, and we brought some beers in a bag and some cups, and I was, you know, I had a cigar. So we go and we sit down, and as we sit down, I notice there's this black guy, like, totally splayed out on the steps with his cane at his feet, and he has this giant iron cross neck tattoo. And he's wearing these, like, funky green pants. But he's, like, splayed out to the point where he's on his back with his, like, you know, face looking up at the sky. But he's, like, positioned himself where he's, like, underneath these two girls who are, like, yammering away on their cell phones.
He's looking up their skirts?
Yeah. So, you know, I just kind of write him off as some wacky guy, you know, trying to be incognito. But I think what it is that he's actually invisible to the girls. You know, he's like some scary guy splayed out on the ground. They're just, you know, ignoring him. And, you know, after a while, I did the same. I think I even, like, pushed his cane out of the way with my foot so I could, you know, move the bag so I could pour the beer into the glasses. But after a while, this other guy comes over. You know, there's, like, this Food Not Bombs thing going on in the park. And so one of the volunteers comes over and props this guy up and tries to feed him some food.
Food, not bombs.
Just food. But I think he's, like, actually missing his tongue or his teeth or something. Because, like, he can't even talk. He's clearly drugged out of his mind. And he's, like, totally covered in gang tattoos. It's not just the neck tattoo. He's got them all over his arm, too. But he can't sit up. He cannot even, you know, keep the food in his mouth. So the Food Not Bombs guy starts asking him questions. Like, you know, yo, dude, how did you, you know, who are you? How did you even get here? So then I tell, you know, the Food Not Bombs guy that he's, you know, a real saint for doing this sort of work because, you know, it's like he's St. Francis, and I feel a little embarrassed that, you know, I'm just sitting there.
They are saint-like.
And I'm just embarrassed that I'm, you know, sitting there, you know, with a beard smoking a cigar. And he tells me that it's actually only his second day. And then he asks me if I've ever seen this guy, and I'm like, no. I definitely would have noticed his fancy green pants. You know, I try to make a joke. But then I realize that his green pants are like hospital pants. They're not, it's not like a fashion statement. But then, as I say this stupid joke, the guy looks at me, and I can see in his eyes, even though he's clearly drugged out on morphine or heroin or crack.
Or crystal meth.
Yes, even though he's got, like, food dribbling down his face and he's totally drugged out, I can see he's totally aware that I just made a joke about him. And he gives me this look like, before all this happened, yo, you never would have made that joke.
Right.
But he's only upright for as long as the Food Not Bombs guy is there to, you know, hold him. As soon as that guy gets up, the gangster topples over again. But this time he falls face down right in between my legs. He almost slams his forehead on the concrete step that's, you know, like between my feet. But he's able to, like, at the last second keep his head up. So he's, like, laying there with his eyes kind of, like, looking up at me.
Well, that's good that he was facing in that direction, because you wouldn't want to be having somebody take a picture if it was the other direction and have that end up on the internet.
That's all I could think about. You know, I'm sitting here smoking a cigar with this guy about to expire between my legs, and all I can think of is, God, I hope no one takes a picture of this.
When I was a fledgling, I would pour a shot from every bottle in my mommy's liquor cabinet into a pint glass and drink the whole thing and go to school. We called it puco. We actually called it puca, but I thought puco read better. Excuse me.
That's cartoonist Tony Millionaire, creator of the comic strip Makis. And right now, he's giving me a live-action reading. In this strip, his character Drinky Crow is sitting at the bar, regaling a bored bartender with his drinking history. Panel 2.
In my party years, I would fill up on malt liquor and screwdrivers, then go to drink anything I could find at the party.
Panel 3.
In my sophisticated years, I put a pint of good vodka in my side pocket so I wouldn't have to drink party whiskey or gin. I don't let you.
Panel 4.
I spent too much time in the drunk tanks, so I switched to only wine and beer. But you can guzzle wine.
Panel 5, this is the bartender's line.
I know, it's beer only now, so why are you always so drunken?
Panel 6.
I drink 15!
Tony Millionaire has been celebrating drunkenness and excess and excessive drunkenness in his comic strip Makis for over 16 years now. Last winter, the Scott Etter Gallery in Brooklyn presented a retrospective of sorts, and I got the chance to talk with Tony as he prepped himself for the opening. There's a definite consistency in the art and humor and excessive drinking of Makis, but I think this is because Tony has let his characters and himself evolve. And as the curtains close on what we used to call the alternative press, Tony Millionaire shows a possible future for alternative comics.
In the beginning, when I first started it, I was young and depressed, and I thought it would be a funny idea to draw depression by having Drinky Crow blow his brains out. I don't do that often anymore, maybe because I'm happier, or maybe because I think that I don't want to be the guy, when some guy has a Drinky Crow t-shirt on, that just shot himself in the head, even though it's already out there. But I also kind of think that if you talk about suicide or depression or drunkenness, if you talk about it, make jokes about it, it really does help people. I have a lot of substance abuse friends that tell me that it's actually really helpful to them. I kind of thought it was just fun to talk about being drunk and fun to talk about being really depressed.
It seems that very early on, you established that you could do whatever you want, even like sometimes changing. It's not even a strip. It could be, you know, photographs of Drinky Crow tattoos. But were there ever boundaries that you even had to worry about?
I have never been told by an editor you shouldn't do that. Although one time, Mike Gentile at the New York Press, when we were all working over there, Kaz and Mark Beyer and Carol Lay and a bunch of people were all doing comic strips for the New York Press in the 90s. He once sent a note out to everybody saying, guys, this is not Screw Magazine. Watch it with the butt jokes. And so I had to cool it with, like, poo-poo humor. Just for a little while. But so whenever I do, I started just, like, write nasty words or really disgusting stuff. I would ask him, is it okay? And he said, yeah. And after a while, he said, do whatever you want.
But this is also, you're talking about a moment right before the internet broke, where the world of do whatever you want is kind of writ large. And, you know, it does seem that it's almost like from a different era now. Doesn't it seem that just as far as aesthetics, I mean, like, look at this strip, another recent one of yours from a few weeks ago. Will you marry me?
Oh, yeah, that's funny. Yeah.
Can you describe this strip?
He's a big fat guy who's courting this woman, and he goes and he's like, she says, I wish he'd wipe the toilet after he uses it. It's disgusting, but I do love him. And he gives her a kiss and walks out. And then in the last panel, you see on the toilet bowl, splattered in diarrhea, it says, will you marry me? My wife wrote that joke because I got some diarrhea splatters on there, and I had a bit of a problem for about a week. And she kept wiping them off or telling me to wipe them off. And so then I said, I need a joke for this week. What am I going to write? She said, just write, will you marry me? And splatters, diarrhea splatters on the toilet.
It does seem that you can tell in the strip that your day-to-day life, your marriage, your kids, your family, road rage at people backing into traffic, It all seems to fit in very, very smoothly.
Yeah.
How your style has always been?
My style has always been kind of waiting for, like Charles Bukowski used to say, wrote on his gravestone or something, don't try. I just really try to wait, for something to come, some joke to come along in the daily life. Some friends of mine will say something funny, or my wife, or my kids sometimes actually write the jokes. But I used to be going out to bars with my friends in Brooklyn, and somebody would say something funny, which would remind me of something else, and then I'd do it. Or they'd just come up with something funny, and I'd steal it directly from them. Sometimes I'd write their name in the strip, but most of the time I would just steal it.
So, 16 years ago, when you started this strip, there was still kind of a newspaper industry. And, but even then, if we were going to talk about a newspaper cartoonist getting ready to try to make that 0.00001% chance that they'll get Garfield money. But for alternative cartoonists like yourself, I mean, there wasn't really even that. Like, how did you kind of imagine that you could make this work?
Well, I figure, I used to be in maybe 25 papers. And, political cartoons get, like, they'll be in, you'll see them in every paper, like hundreds of papers, because every little college wants the political cartoons. But this stuff, it's a lot of body humor, and it's a lot of, it's just comedy. So it's not in as many papers. Fortunately, it's in the bigger papers in the bigger cities. But I figured always, as long as there's one paper that's still running it, I'll keep drawing it. And hopefully, and now I'm doing it on, I'm putting them on my website. But I don't know, it's going to be kind of tough just doing it for my website.
Really? I love your website. As far as cartoonist websites go, I think what's really great about yours is the community, like the comments sometimes, and even your Facebook page. It seems like you really figured it out. But then recently you made a reference to, man, I'm so glad I have the deadline, because if I didn't have the deadline, I don't know if this would work.
Right.
Can you explain like what doesn't work for you about not being in a paper, since you do kind of have this kind of amazing online space for yourself?
Well, monkeys.com is set up for people who really follow the strip, want to see what the strip is this week, and they'll go there I always write monkeys.com on the bottom of my strip, so people will go to it, and then they can get more information about it or see other stuff that's going on. But the whole point of this thing is that it's a newspaper comic strip, and the fact that it's online is just kind of peripheral to that. And so that you can actually, because a lot of the papers, they don't have very much space. It's not their fault. So it's like, real estate in a newspaper page is really expensive. You have to put it next to all the prostitute ads.
You do realize that this whole newspaper thing is kind of almost over.
If there were no newspapers left, I'd end up getting it on newspapers online. Yeah, of course. Because I think that if you start a weekly comic strip, you should do it forever. And you should not stop until you're dead.
I've been sitting on this Tony Millionaire interview for a few months now, partly because I didn't know where to put it, and partly because I wanted to save it for a special episode. Well, the other day it hit me that if I took all the segments like this one that are cluttering up my desk and make a show out of them, I would have a special episode. And believe it or not, my dear listeners, this is the 50th edition of Too Much Information. So, huzzah! Hooray! You know, to tell you the truth, I've never understood this fascination with number 50. Of course, I'm aware that in the Kabbalah there are 50 gates of wisdom, but there are also 50 gates of impurity. And if, as some surmise, these cancel each other out and give us the magical, mystical zero, then I don't see why 50 deserves any special treatment. I mean, why celebrate TMI number 50? Why not TMI 37? I don't recall what it was, but surely it's better than this chock-a-block nonsense. Well, this party, it's not going to shut down with number 50. I've got a new idea. I think that from now on, I'm going to celebrate everything, every moment, like it's a jubilee. I might need some help with the refreshments, though.
My name is Pierre-Louis Collin, and the book I wrote was called in French Le Guide des Jolies Femmes de Paris, which more or less means The Guide of the Pretty Woman in Paris, I guess, something like that.
I learned about Pierre-Louis Collin and his book, How to Watch Pretty Women, when I was in Paris earlier this summer. His thesis is that watching women is one of the most profound ways a man can pass the time. Now, yours truly has lost countless hours to this very pastime. In fact, it's the main reason I've only produced 50 hours of radio over the last 18 months. The total absence of resources and money, completely irrelevant. My amateur radio program is a slow-moving endeavor because I spend all of my time staring into space. So I figured I would meet up with this professional and learn how to do things better.
I'm not a professional at all. It's just, it's a joke. I mean, the book is about, it's a joke, you know, writing a Guide des Jolies Femmes de Paris, it's nothing, you know, no. I used to say that I'm a femologue, which means like a womanologist, you know, I'm a womanologist, so, but it's for fun, you know, no one is a womanologist, but I can say I'm a femologue, but it's, you know, it's crap, but it's just that I don't have technical skills. I just have that consciousness of the importance of that. So I want to share that consciousness. That's it. And consciousness of the time that goes, of the beauty of women, consciousness of the pleasure of being alive, the pleasure of just wasting time, which is a beautiful thing to do. We are actually Rue Montorgueil, which is one of the best parts in Paris, if not the best part in Paris, because it's mostly 30 years old fashion women, so they are very free with their body, they are very much into seduction. This street, Rue Montorgueil, is a market, and what I think is that markets are really often the best places to watch women. Because you are hungry when you're here, you know, you have nice smells, and it's always the same pleasures, you know, you're in. It opens your appetite, as we say in French, and I think the best time there was a friend of mine who works in wine who told me that they were always making their organizing their tastings at around 11:30 a.m. because it's right before the big hunger of noon, and then it's after you're not full yet, so you have all your papilles. I don't know what papilles is in English, are open, you know, the taste buds are open in your mouth, and I think it's mostly the same here. Your taste buds are open. She's beautiful. It's Sunday morning, so she doesn't wear a bra. So there is a beautiful move inside her sweater. That's wonderful. I'm sorry, I didn't listen to your question.
My question was, what do you mean when you say it's respectful to watch women walking down the street?
There are different reasons why I think it's respecting women to watch women. Basic reason is that if this girl decides to wear that nice dress, short dress, it's not to frighten birds, you know. It's because she wants to be beautiful and she wants people to know that she's beautiful. So we are respectful to her. We think that she is conscious of what she does, and it's not something that she did without knowing what she was doing. She's not crazy, she's not alienée, she's not mentally retarded. You know, that if she does it, to let us know that she has nice legs. So as we are respectful to her, we notice that she has nice legs. The second reason why it's respecting women is that it's because when you take so much pleasure watching women, you want that pleasure to go on, not only to go on this moment, but next year, in 10 years. And I know that if so many guys go on insulting, assaulting women, insulting them, being rude, be rude to them, they won't wear short dresses anymore, you know? And so it's just a matter of conservation. Because they make pleasure to me. That's amazing. That's so nice. I want to thank them. I don't want to hurt them.
So what kind of reaction did you get from French women?
There were two types of reactions. First one was from the women who didn't read the book, who were horrified, who thought that was awful, that was sexist, that was machist, and that shouldn't be allowed. But they hadn't read the book. And then some women read the book and they loved it, most of them. Probably some of them didn't like it and didn't tell me, but the only mails I received from readers were from women. My mother-in-law thought it was a poem about women. My old aunt, which is 80 years old, which lives in the country, called me to say, when I read your book, I feel beautiful. I feel like I'm beautiful. Thank you so much. And so all the women who made the effort to read the book figured out that I wasn't only saying all women should be 20 years old, skinny and tall, and be dressed up as fashion models. I was, on the contrary, I'm saying in the book that you have to watch a 70 years old woman, that she can be beautiful, that she can have, even her, if her body is getting old or something and is not as beautiful as it was 20 years before, she can still have beautiful eyes, she can still have a wonderful smile. I'm talking about all kinds of women, and the way every woman can be beautiful. So that's for the woman who read the book. And then there was my wife, which was a third category of women, because when I published the book, she was pregnant, so that was a difficult time for her, because she wasn't as beautiful as she usually is. And so I was on the newspaper every day. I was on TV. I was on the radio saying how I like beautiful women. And then she was being fat at home waiting for me. And I think she didn't really like it. But still, the main idea of my book is not about men, women, seduction, pleasure. It's about the time that goes, that passes. It's about the death that is at the end of the way. And the fact that if you don't enjoy life now, just that moment, it will be over. And the best symbol of that is that lady that we just saw with the red sweater. You see, you didn't notice her. I tried to catch the more I could from her. But now I will never see her anymore in my life. So if I didn't, if I hadn't paid attention to her, there would be no point being alive. The thing is that you usually don't think watching women as a noble occupation. You think it's wasting time, but wasting time is a very important thing to do. You just take pleasure of worshipping the time that passes.
When I was a kid, I had a 12-foot by 14-foot laminated map of the Atlantic Ocean in my room. At the right end of the wall was Africa. At the left end of the wall was the Eastern Seaboard. And Chicago, where I lived, wasn't even on the map. Coming from a totally landlocked area of Illinois, I was really into the huge hurricanes that would form over the Atlantic Ocean. They were totally removed from where I was. Nothing like that could ever develop near me. And because of this morbid fascination with the beauty and the destruction of these storms, I got really into tropical weather. Every day I would turn on Channel 40, the weather channel. On the 50th of every hour I was awake, I'd turn to the tropical weather update to get the locations of developing tropical systems. And I would write down the latitude and the longitude of the developing storms on a piece of paper. I'd bring the piece of paper into my room to plot its coordinates on my map. I tracked these tropical storms every summer, plotting the storms every 3 hours when the new reports came out. In May, June, and early July, all the storms would be in the Gulf of Mexico or the near tropics, and I would mark the map with my dry erase marker, red and blue and tons of marker crap all over the wall. By mid-July through late September, though, that's when the clouds rolling off Africa would almost immediately bubble up into tropical waves far out into the ocean, tropical depressions, tropical storms, and then hurricanes. Big, powerful hurricanes that would take 5, sometimes 7 days to chug across the Atlantic Ocean. If the storm was named on a Saturday, by the next Saturday I'd have something to do that night. Watch a hurricane make landfall somewhere I'd never been, like North Carolina or something. I wasn't the only person doing this. The Weather Channel had 2 severe weather experts, Jim Flenderson and Alexandra Alendo. And they were always there with me on the 50th of the hour.
We are just arriving on the scene here in Tuscaloosa. Look at this. Cars, metal, everything just...
When a hurricane made landfall, the Weather Channel would throw to storm tracker Jim Flenderson on the Gulf Coast for hurricanes and in Oklahoma or Kansas during tornado season. I saw him once when he came to Chicago to film a blizzard, and got him to sign a photo of himself for a grammar school project.
Oh, Jesus! Listen to that! Son of a... Holy smokes!
The other severe weather expert was this painted lady meteorologist named Alexandra Alendo.
Well, we now have tropical storm Dan.
Yeah, we're gonna dissect it for you.
She was not as brave as Jim Flenderson. She would scream and shout as the tropical weather systems came in, always from the safety of the studio, always with her thick eyeliner slightly running. Like Jim and me, she had also plotted the storms, but she was always underneath the fluorescent lights in the studio, never out in the field with the storm or in my bedroom with a dry erase marker.
The waves are crashing onto the coast of North Carolina. A tornado watch is now in effect.
When I was a kid, my first taste of scandal was in the relationship between Jim Flenderson and Alexandra Alendo. When Jim wasn't out tracking a storm, they were always on the severe weather desk together, flirting with each other.
She be careful. Is that Alexandra? How beautiful she is. Anyway, here we go. Charleston, West Virginia, right up through southern Pennsylvania.
But was Jim and Alexandra's relationship more than just a pleasant work chemistry? According to the weather chat rooms I went to, it was. They claimed Jim and Alexandra were actually dating, secretly.
All right, we're just going to get this out of the way right at the top of
do
the
it.
Show. Are you sure
yeah,
I should?
Do it, yeah.
You sure?
Get it out of the way.
All right. Should I say my name now?
Say your name. Just don't give
say
the address.
Name,
they'll be all over you.
I'm Alexandra.
Spotted at bars in Cobb County, Georgia, the headquarters of the Weather Channel. She'd sometimes be away from her post at the Weather Channel desk when he was away tracking tornadoes and hurricanes, causing many in the chat rooms to speculate that she'd gone with him on the trip, to sit in some out-of-the-way hotel, waiting for him to come back from reporting out the storm.
Huge waves continue to come in here as this surge makes its way up onto the beach, occasionally crashing, pulling down debris.
So when Jim or Alexandra were on the screen in 1996, giving the latest bulletin on Hurricane Hortense's slow, beautiful crawl across the Atlantic Ocean. I wondered if they were just hurrying through the five-minute updates to attend to more lusty matters.
As long as we have this onshore flow, I'll keep you posted here from Kill Devil Hills in the Outer Banks. As most of the power...
There was just one problem with Jim and Alexandra. They were both married to other people. The Weather Channel chat rooms took Jim's side. He was just a hard-working meteorologist thrown into the belly of various tropical beasts, lonely for company away from his family, living in upstate New York. Alexandra was the homewrecker, stuck in Cobb County, Georgia, her husband, a pediatric dentist, always around when she needed him. She wanted some danger. Then, in 2002, the top dog tropical weather watcher, John Hope,
died. Profound sadness and regret that we must report on the passing of a friend and colleague. Our hurricane expert, John Hope, passed away this morning as a result of complications following heart surgery.
The relationship was put to the test. They gave Jim the job, and Alexandra left. Did she quit in protest? Was she jealous? Did he decide to go the straight and narrow? These were pressing questions, to be sure. But this was also around the time I started high school, and I had other priorities. And by the time I went to college, I didn't even own a TV. I recently got my dad to send me the weather maps that had been hanging in my childhood bedroom. I just moved into a new apartment and signed a year-long lease. I'd been renting month to month before, in part out of convenience, but also out of dread because, up until recently, I thought I had a brain tumor or something. But I don't have a brain tumor or anything. So I've decided to start doing the things I like to do. I've even started checking in on Jim and Alexandra. Jim is still scouting out major storms. He's the top dog at the Weather Channel now, and he's been there for longer than I've been alive. Alexandra, though, she left the Weather Channel sometime around 2002. No one is quite sure about what happened to her. On YouTube, if you search her name, you get dozens of tribute videos made by fans missing her at the Weather Channel desk. But they all look like memorial tribute videos, like she died or something. I visited the Weather Channel message boards again this weekend to see if the diehard watchers had anything to say. And no one really knows anything about her. It seems like she just disappeared, and everyone forgot about her, including Jim Flenderson. But I have a theory. I imagine her sitting at home with her pediatric dentist husband, drinking coffee from the comfort of an air-conditioned kitchen in Georgia, away from any dangerous weather systems in her temperature-controlled house.
American publisher called me Chris Blaine because he said he didn't want to make a French name on the books, on the front of the books, because he said, Chris Blaine, you don't know exactly where he comes from. He can be American, you know, Chris Blaine.
Christophe Blaine is an internationally famous French cartoonist. His most popular series, Isaac the Pirate and Gus, have both been translated into numerous languages. But his American publisher, First Second, put the name Chris Blaine on the cover of Gus.
And I like this idea because it's very funny for me to be Chris Blaine.
Blaine told me that his American publisher also put future volumes of Gus on hold because of the financial crisis. But Blaine thinks it's because Americans just don't share the French's passion for Westerns. but he hopes to continue the story about his adventurous and amorous gunfighter soon.
Gus is my favorite series. This is the one I am happiest to work on. I love the character. I feel very close to them. They are like close friends. And I can argue with them. I have a passionate relationship with them. They are getting old with me.
I get the sense that Blonde likes to have someone to blame for the pace at which his stories come out. The latest volume of his other series, Isaac the Pirate, was published in 2005. Isaac is a painter who ends up sailing around the world on a pirate voyage. And along the way, he meets women and new friends and discovers his artistic destiny. And when we last see him, his father and his lover Alice are still waiting for his return, even though he's back in France, tangled up with a band of robbers. Blonde says that with the passage of time, his stories and his characters go through radical changes, and he likes this.
I created Isaac about 10 years ago, and the idea of the story has completely changed after years, you know. Yeah, I was not in the same feeling at the fifth volume that at the first. The characters have a different meaning for me, and I like that. The first idea of the story was about Isaac and Alice, for example, and I was sure they met again. Now I'm not sure.
As a dedicated reader, though, I just want to know what happens, and it looks like I might finally get that chance on the big screen. When I met with Blonde, his friend and colleague, Joan Svar, was just finishing up the animated version of his tale, The Rabbi's Cat. And the plan is to make a movie of Isaac next. Blonde says that the French film industry has fallen in love with comics, but it's different than it is here. It's not about big-budget superhero reboots. It's about storytelling.
The filmmaker, the producer, are looking for a new way to tell stories, not only adaptation. And now the producers think that you can be a cartoonist and a director. It's rather the same job, you know, and it's very good for us because it's more the film industry who is seduced by the cartoonist.
I like the idea of the film industry turning to French cartoonists for new ideas, but I'm doubtful it will really happen. I mean, I just saw a trailer for Battleship, a $200 million blockbuster based on the Hasbro game. But then again, if it was Battleship by Christophe Blond, I'd definitely go see it.
When you write your stories, you tell about a very deep question, you know, you have inside you. Even when the subject is not doesn't seem to be close to your actual life, you can write a story about Mohicans, you know? You are not Mohicans. You live in Paris, you live in New York. But in fact, this story has something to do with your deep questions. And you can't control all this thing. If you try to control and to be smart with your stories, you make very boring stories. All the things you can't control are the most interesting, I think. This is the most agreeable, the most...
nicest moment,
please. Yes, the most pleasant moment when you write a story. You feel like... it's like taking drug for me.
Of course, yeah. I thought I would, you know, be talking to you about your third world problems, but I think
just
you
because
were...
of my income level, you know, my... But my bills seem to get paid, but not by me. Yeah, I almost have like a living trust fund, a person.
God.
The silent hand. What is it called? The invisible hand.
No, we call it the sugar mama.
Capitalist. Right, the sugar mama. I'm totally stuck having to go over there. And no matter how long I'm there, I'm never there long enough. I've been getting there once a week. It's good enough, you know, the car, the $500 advance, the insurance. Oh, my God, the insurance was like buying another car. That happened last week. Tomorrow is laundry day, so I'm bringing over all the laundry and the bills, the telephone bill, all that kind of stuff.
She bought you a new car?
Can you believe that? She didn't buy me like a brand new car off the lot kind of new car, but it's a real new car to me. It doesn't have a dent on it. It's a 2000 something. What is it called? Honda Accord. These are pretty good cars. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it at all. It's good.
How did you pull this off?
Luckily, 52 years old, so pretty cute, huh? If Sugar Mama didn't come by to rescue me, things would be really tough. Things are tough. And I try not to take too much advantage of Sugar Mama. That's why I try to throw her some sex here and there or whatever, you know?
So let me ask you this. Is having a sugar mama a first world problem or a third world problem?
People in the third world get by too, you know? And sometimes they have sugar mamas. You wonder, like, how do these people survive? And a lot of them are on drugs and stuff too. You know, when you look at documentaries about what's going on in India, the world's largest democracy, like, they care.
Is having a sugar mama a first world problem or a third world problem?
Well, the whole designate of the three worlds is an old Kissinger term, you know, from the real politic days of the 60s. I mean, to cut the world into thirds is just pretty arbitrary. And it was done, you remember how, do you know what the second world was? We all know what the third world was.
Where is the second world? You know, I don't know anything about the second world.
And I know the answer, but even you don't know the answer. And you're a pretty educated person that does reports for the freaking Guardian, and you didn't know what the second world was.
No, I did not.
Do you have any guesses?
No, like a Brazil?
I bet nobody, none of your listeners probably know either. I bet even Noam Chomsky knows. It's outside of me and Noam Chomsky, nobody knows what the second world was. It's easy. Now I'm going to tell you, and you're going to say, oh, of course. It was the communist bloc. Any communist country was the second world. Because communism made it so that people weren't abhorrently starving like in Haiti or Malawi. You did have a certain evening out. Like China was the second world. China was never referred to as a third world country, only by people who didn't know what they were talking about. China was and still is, if you're going to use that term, second world. So is Cuba. It's communism.
Is having a sugar mama a first world problem or a third world problem?
I don't consider myself part of the first world, but that's not true either, because when I'm on the Hollywood movie sets, eating those big lunches and those grand buffets, I am definitely part of the elite in the world. If you look at it worldwide, I'm like one of the top 10%. But if you look at it Hollywood, I'm way, way, way down below the poverty level here in Hollywood. I mean, the world has such disparagency. I could never say that word right. Disparagency.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me the word? The word, there's beauty in all the words. There is a lot of disparity in the world. And if the United States is really number one, I'd hate to see what the rest of the world looks like. Because there's a lot of garbage around here, and it's festering. America is really showing its cracks with the disparity of wealth.
Peter, can you just answer the question? Is having a sugar mama a third world problem or a first world problem?
I would say that it's a universal problem.
Though you may not drive a great big Cadillac, gangsta white walls, TV antennas in the back, you may not have
This episode of Too Much Information is called Be Thankful for What You've Got. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen and Laura Mayer. And it featured Peter Choice, Tony Millionaire, Pierre-Louis Collomb, Laura Mayer, and Christophe Blanc. On the TMI playlist page, you can find links and images, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast as well. All that at WFMU.org.
Join us at the same time next week for another edition of Too Much Information. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up now, For the Record, with Dave Emery.
Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 671, titled Update on the Meltdown, Part 4, Germany, the Underground Reich, and the Global Financial Crisis. This program is being recorded on April 26th of the year 2009. I so often start broadcasts by referencing listeners to the massive website. It's a new Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com. It's got a tremendous amount of information on it. Those of you who are only listening to the broadcasts at this point are missing by far and away the greater part of the For the Record experience, to coin a phrase. This broadcast will exemplify why listeners should use the website. In particular, I'm going to be referencing one of the books that I have for download, one of the old anti-fascist books that I have for download for free on the website. I'd like to encourage people who listen to this program and take this seriously to download basically everything you can, ideally the entire website, all of the print files, all of the audio files, put them on a series of flash drives and or your hard drive, and save them for when civilization is trying to crawl up out of the darkness again, and they need a little bit of a perspective on what happened, what brought about the new dark ages, because I am, as veteran listeners would know, I'm not relatively pessimistic, I'm very pessimistic, but among the books that we're going to be referencing in this broadcast is Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens, a book that preceded his book The New Germany and the Old Nazis in 1961. Germany Plots with the Kremlin is from 1953. We're also going to be accessing some other information from that book, and we're also going to be accessing some information from the book The Thousand Year Conspiracy, Secret Germany Behind the Mask, from 1943. In order to understand history, in order to understand current events, I should say, we really have to understand history. And what we're going to be looking at in this broadcast, and certainly in future broadcasts, is the role of, on the one hand, and relatively superficially, Germany, but below that, the Underground Reich, and in particular, the economic network put together by Martin Bormann, utilizing Germany's cartel connections during and after World War II. The cartel connections were put in place at the beginning, in the immediate aftermath of World War I, utilizing those cartel connections in the coming Cold War and Germany's effective economic looting of Europe during the occupation, were the foundations for the Bormann Capital Network. Now, use the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It's available for download for free on the website. Don't try to read these books, by the way, on your computer monitor. I would put them on a flash drive or download them and then have them printed up. The copyrights are long expired, with the exception of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And that copyright belongs to the Manning family, and years ago I got permission to reprint the book. So please do use those books. Don't try to read them online. That book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is not only a key to understanding these broadcasts, as I hope this broadcast will help to illustrate, it's critical in understanding the events that are overtaking this country and this world at this time. I'm going to begin by referencing an article that was sent to me by a listener. Now, this is from a magazine, an online magazine, which is Christian fundamentalist in its orientation. It has a different sort of Christian fundamentalist orientation, though. Some of their references draw on what they call biblical prophecy. I want to make it clear, in case people are not aware of it, that I am not a fundamentalist Christian, and I place no stock in biblical prophecy or in any other sort of religious prophecy. So I'm omitting where they talk about biblical prophecy here. However, this particular article from thetrumpet.com is not only well-written, but has what is, in my opinion, some very good analysis. And I think because of the good writing, I think that reading this article will be effective in helping to communicate the points that I want to communicate here. And so for that purpose, I'm going to go ahead and read this article. But please do observe the caveat. This is a Christian publication, and it does sort of in apposition, it references biblical prophecy. It's also quite scholarly, and I think the biblical prophecy element is for those who are, shall we say, at the more elemental rungs of the Christian ladder, to coin a term. But please observe the caveat about the biblical prophecy here. That notwithstanding, I think the article is well-written and valuable. In particular, I think the emphasis here will lend itself well to an oral presentation. So here goes, to begin with. This is an article from The Trumpet, and from their online edition, thetrumpet.com. This is called Germany Anticipated This Financial Crisis 60 Years Ago. It's by a fellow named Brad McDonald, who is one of their columnists, and it's dated March 19th, 2009. And the subtitle is, Some Germans Are Not in the Least Bit Surprised by the Global Economic Collapse. Here's Why. And the article goes on to say, The Trumpet keeps a keen eye on Germany. For nearly two decades, the Trumpet staff has waited, watched, and written about the emergence of a globally dominant, German-led bloc of European states. We have warned specifically that a spectacular global financial crisis centered in the United States will likely bring this event to fruition. We are not entirely alone in this expectation. The following is a snippet from a secret memorandum written by high-ranking German officers and distributed among an elite group of German leaders in Bonn and other parts of the world. It is an electrifying picture of current events. Now, before I go ahead and read this excerpt, let me note that this is an excerpt from a Madrid circular letter that was put together by the Nazi government in exile that effectively ran not only Germany through a secret network of control called a Führungsring. We talk about this in AFA number 37 at great length. It's dealt with at great length by T.H. Tettens in his aforementioned book, The New Germany and the Old Nazis, from 1961.